This is tape number two, side number two.
So I'm trying to give you just a simple example of, you know, if they're separate, they got one set of response. But if you combine, it can change the entire picture.
So that is what you meant by the term synergistic effects.
Right.
Okay. Go back to the tank farm vapors issue in 2004. This seemed, well, it got a huge amount of publicity, and it seemed to kind of open a new window in the thought processes. It seems like before that time, there hadn't been a lot of attention to the chemicals. And would you agree with that?
Entirely.
And then what changed? I mean, was it simply something that we got through and now we're back to normal status, or did things change for the better?
Somebody recognized something about problems, potential problems or otherwise. And back, I think it was in the very late 80s that I could pinpoint it. We had a fellow by the name of Elton Hewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T.
I know him.
Come in and supposedly do some research that he knew absolutely everything there was about tank farms. And he even stated in his report, which I have a copy of, that don't investigate any further because I have the answers that you need, is what I'm paraphrasing. And there's no sense in doing any more research because I have researched it. Like I say, I have a copy of that report with that type of paraphrased remark. What I said is very, very close to what he said and what he wrote.
How many months, or was it more than a year, that then the tank farm workers were all on respirators all the time?
There was some instances in East Area, I believe it was with Sea Farm first, to where some people were complaining, and I'm not sure what all triggered it now because it's been a ways back and I was not over there at the time. And I know that there was some valid concerns to where they put everybody on air. And after Elton Hewitt did his report and stuff, it wasn't that long afterwards that everybody came off air.
And so now it's supposedly voluntary.
Yes.
And you talked earlier about if it's voluntary and only a few people do it, that really upsets the shift scheduling.
Right.
So do you feel there's pressure not to wear it?
Definitely, yeah. And that's where you get the cowboy factor that's been identified for years. You get the cowboy factor come back in because, if at all possible, they will get the job done no matter how much they ought to be on SCBA.
I've heard of it because, I've talked to a lot of people who worked here very early, 1940s and 50s.
Yeah. And by the way, some of the cowboys are sick now. They're coming down with stuff. This one guy has such a hideous rash on his leg that it looks black. It is black. And it's all these individual rashes that have just grown together. And the blackness is old dead blood that's underneath his skin surface that lacks oxygen. It turns black. But he's also got some red eruptions that you can see in between there, to where you know that it's fresh blood that is oozing up in between the scar tissue and all this dead blood, because you can see it's red. And it's just a massive rash. And the first thing that comes to his mind is, how much can I get? How much money can I get? Is that the real answer? No. The real answer is, how much of my health can I get back? But these guys, there's other people with that cowboy group that are suffering effects and saying nothing.
Is this person still coming to work each day?
Every day. All of them.
And do they do a full day's work? Can they?
I'm not gonna go there as to what their schedule is.
Okay.
I also know of a union steward that has talked to me about people such as welders and pipe fitters that worked at the fabrication shop, and they had a lead melter that was there, and they didn't have it properly exhausted or any kind of scrubbing or anything. And it, being a melter, it put the lead into fumes and vapors. And there is at least one guy that he identified that is at home, off work, waiting to die. And pipe fitters, HPTs, operators, and welders are some of the worst groups for exposures out here.
So you're saying that Hanford has done a fairly good job with rad protection, pretty
yes.
much.
The rad training has been overkill.
And the chemical training now is just catching up, or is it not? Is it not catching up?
I was supposed to have chat class once a year. I had it once initially.
What's that?
Chemical hazardous awareness training.
Okay.
Chat.
Okay.
It was supposed to be conducted by industrial hygienists. I went once. I haven't been back yet.
As a result of the vapor issues, it seemed like, you know, it's from what you read in the newspaper, it seemed like there was a lot of chemical research going on now, you know, regarding Hanford and Hanford's vapors. Is that not true? But is that just...
I don't know, because they haven't communicated that to us. I myself feel that it couldn't come soon enough. If you're saving exposure, you're saving lives. If you're saving lives, you've got some happy workers.
Right.
I don't know of anybody that's happy out there now. They're just tolerating it because they know they've already been exposed in most cases. Why don't I quit? For the same reason. I already know I've been exposed. And I've already got the symptoms. And I'm not retirement age, so what do I do?
Let's go back to, I wanted to go back, if we could, to when you first became sick. Or the 93, thereabouts, when you first got symptoms. How'd that affect your family? What kind of, there's got to be some secondary effects.
Among some of the things that I've already described, they also talk about personality changes for lead and mercury, that you can become suicidal, you can become very violent, Mad Hatter's disease with mercury.
Is that what, you know, I never put two and two together.
Michelle.
I've heard that old expression.
I have been educated.
I've heard that expression since I was a child, you know,
Mad Hatters, because they used, how it was used exactly, I'd have to research deeper. But what was used was mercury.
Oh, mercury. Mad Hatter's disease is mercury poisoning.
Yeah.
I did not know that. I'm writing that down. Let's see. But when you began to become sick and you went to conventional doctors and you went to HEHF, and they all said, what, do you have allergies?
Well, HEHF first, hoping to get something more immediate type relief.
Right.
Maybe it wasn't that bad a deal, or what bug is going around for everybody now.
Sure.
That type of deal, is a flu bug or a cold or what. And so I went for what you say mild type relief, I guess.
Yeah.
And it was allergies or sinus infection. There was a few hints there, though, that I couldn't put anything together with. And I'd have to go over the paperwork to show you what I'm talking about. But I have it flagged on my health records with some of the different things that they said. And putting two and two together for the last 3 years or so, it fits like a glove with the exposures. even through HEHF in their own words.
So you think that they at least suspected or knew that you had something other than allergies or a bug, but they didn't say it flat out, they said it in terms of a few hints?
What I'd call a hint, you know, but here for several years they says I had a low-grade fever. Okay, low-grade fever. Where are you supposed to take that? To your own doctor? I did. I had lab tests done. And I've heard from people that their doctors have said, oh, Hanford health evaluations are a good moneymaker for us because they trigger going to get special tests done and get labs and all this stuff, and nobody finds nothing. You know, okay, it's hearsay, but I hear other people saying it, and I see nothing to diffuse the argument. And, you know, low-grade fever, I went to my doctor. Yeah, okay, here, satisfy the deductible and all that stuff. Needlessly spending money because they found nothing.
No cause for the low-grade.
No
fever.
Cause for it.
Just said.
Because they're not looking that direction. Who in the hell would ever think that you're poisoned by toxic metals or chemicals out here?
Is there any remediation? Is there anything, once you've been exposed, that can be done?
I'm doing it right now. My best shot that I've researched and found out, my best shot is chelation. I've been doing that for right at a year. And do I want to stay on it? No. I'm uncomfortable. I don't sleep good at night. I got insomnia. I hurt. I get eruptive phases with my skin, my nose, my sinuses. I got tinnitus for about 4 years now, I guess.
In your ear?
Constant. I just ignore it. And it's anywhere, most of the time, from moderate to loud. But I ignore it. I just tell them when I get my hearing test every year, oh, I got tinnitus. Okay, well, not much change from the year before. Everything's fine. You know, fitness for duty, I hope that never enters into it because, you know, I've always been fit for duty. Except when I lost 40% of my lung capacity because of inhalations of God knows what all, other than what has shown up on these tests that they're trying to refute.
Is there any way to reverse that, to get that lung capacity back?
I'll find out Monday because I'm going to have a complete bank of respiratory testing done. But right now it's sitting at about 40% loss of lung capacity, which doesn't mean that I'm damaged 40%. If you only get 3/5 of a breath of air every time you try to breathe, just under normal circumstance, and it's that much worse when you try to do some sort of work and exercise, then what are they going to say? You only got 40% damage? No. If you don't breathe right, you don't exercise right. If you don't exercise right, you get fat. And that's where I'm at now. And I don't enjoy it at all. I've always prided myself in being top shape up until about the time I hit 50. And then I saw it going downhill.
So around 1993, it seemed like a lot of things just got worse. Almost suddenly, or at least took a real turn for the worse. But you kept coming to work every day.
Yeah.
And just putting lotions on the skin rashes and things like that. Is that right?
Well, you know, I know I had eruptions, but it was looking more like rosacea or lupus at the time. A lot of stuff with my sinuses, the allergy shots I was going through, the allergy tests. No, it's not allergies, according to the doctor's paperwork.
Mm-hmm.
The rashes were more prevalent over the last few years. I had that rash on my leg really bad up until maybe about 9 months ago. Is chelation helping at all? I'm still wiped out, but when you get this stuff in your system, it wipes you out. And when you get it out of your system, it also takes it out of you. Mm-hmm. And I'm exhausted at night. I'm exhausted.
But you still don't have the capacity to sleep well, is that right?
No. Don't have the capacity to sleep well. I can't do all the work around the house and the yard like I used to. When I hired on here and tried to get on the Whoops SWAT team, it's documented that I was in tip-top shape. I was in exceptional shape. So I got a pretty good baseline to give them about mm-hmm. what went on here.
Sure. I don't know. Maybe we should break for lunch at 12:35.
Yeah, I don't know. It's amazing.
We're back from lunch. This is tape 2, side 2. And we're going to talk about some experiences at the Redox tank car unloading area in 200 West area in the mid-1980s.
Okay, we had a out in the open facility. All it was some rails that went up to the site of Redox and behind Redox by several yards. And the tracks, I believe, are still there. They had a cement enclosed area that had three tanks, if I recall. I know there's at least two, but I'm positive there was three, to where rail cars would come in from different parts of the site, between 100 areas and 300 areas, is what we heard. And the only place that they had to unload them was out in this open place. So there was times where it could be very hot, other times where it could be just bitter cold, depending on the time of year. The hookups for the rail car were on top, and I can't remember the pumping mechanism that they had for getting them out, getting the liquids out, but we set it up, and it took just about all shift, if not all shift, to pump it out. And when you're down there for a while, you start noticing a few things that you might not have noticed before. And one of them was that there was a telephone pole with a heavy guide wire on it, pretty much like an anchor for the telephone pole to keep it from pulling over. Anyhow, this metal cable had some yellow powdery-looking stuff on it, and it kind of built up rather thick. Well, kind of curious about it, and ended up thinking, is that yellow cake like in uranium? And the weird part there is, well, why would it be on that cable unless it was drifting around in the air as a powder or a vapor, and for some reason showing an attraction to that metallic cable? So we checked it out with a GM. We were entitled to use Geiger counters then. And I remember it being radioactive, probably, I'm not sure, but I'd say probably mid-second scale, if not more. And so anyhow, we completed our job, and I don't remember if we asked around any more about it or not. We were curious very, very much about it, but I don't think we could get any more information during that time. It would most likely be that, you know, you don't have a need to know. So anyhow, once again, that's another job to where we had P100 cartridge filters for our mask, or in the case of once you finished the hookup to the rail car, you didn't even have to be on mask as you were working around the area. It was all contained because the piping had been put together. So anyhow, few years later, that whole operation was changed over to the rail car unloading facility they have now in East Area, and I don't think they've used that for years either. 244U, I believe, is the facility. I can't be positive, but it's easy enough to spot. And why they ceased accepting any more rail car shipments, I don't know. We were never made aware of the contents other than it was rad waste. It was liquid waste. So I can't give any more information than that, other than it's another example of not having the right information so you can have the right PPE and do the job the way it should have been done.
When you pumped out, where did you pump to?
Those three tanks behind the retainer wall.
Okay.
That's what we pumped directly into.
And then, do you know where it ever went from there? Did it get transferred to a tank?
It did go into the tank farm system from there.
And when you're talking about East Area, is it the 244 UR or AR vault? Probably AR vault. It's right. It's a little.
It's on the hill where they have the. Well, it's known as the rail car unloading facility.
Is it a little square building that today has got a lot of pink asbestos painting on it?
No, that would be the old AR vault area.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It's not that.
Okay.
Where is it in the East Area?
It's right next door to it.
Okay.
Right next door.
Okay.
Directly south of it, on the Purex side.
Okay, now I know what you mean.
Yeah.
And that was, at least over in East Area, that was used for, you know, pretty significantly radioactive loads.
Right.
Because the vaults are pretty contaminated today. So has this been, this redox cement area, has that been torn down?
The three tanks and the cement area were all hauled off by a truck to the burial grounds. And I know the pit that they are buried in, they were backfilled with sand so that, to support the tank itself.
Right, right. Did you ever ask a supervisor or anybody about this yellow coating on the cable?
I'm sure I did, but I can't recall. Jim Perham was my supervisor, and his boss was Oscar Strunk.
And they either didn't answer or gave an answer such as?
I don't recall any kind of answer other than it's waste from the 300 area or it's waste from 100 area.
So it was radioactive, definitely, and yet it was allowed to stay there? Nobody tried to go and clean it off there or fix it?
Well, it was contained in the tank. And then from there, it had to have gone by transfer into tank farms, but I don't know the details there.
When I was asking that question, I meant the yellow material on the guide wire.
Oh.
Was that ever removed, cleaned, or fixed in place?
I doubt it.
It was there every day?
Not to my knowledge. You can see it to some degree and measure it every time by Geiger counting.
My gosh. What did the workers say? Did they just kind of stay away from it, or did they say, that's spooky, that spooks us, I don't want to go over there?
Everyone was kind of wondering, you know, what that was all about, but never got an answer. Stay away from it.
Well, that'd be good advice.
Yeah, but if it's in the air or, you know, collecting on that cable because of moisture or whatever, you know, you just didn't know what was in the air.
Exactly. Could we talk about a couple of places you mentioned hantavirus exposures? Could you talk about those?
Oh, yeah. as part of my job, we're involved with cleanup. Okay, if you have facilities that are messed up, you're responsible to clean them up. Mm-hmm. Okay, so unfortunately, we had a lot of unfortunately, we had a lot of messed up facilities. Most of them was because of rodents, but some of them was because of pigeons. Mm-hmm. And either way, these facilities had to be cleaned up. And I knew it was part of our job. I'm of the old mentality that if it's part of your job, you should fix it, take care of it. And so I ended up inheriting some of these jobs that no one else, I'm not going to get in that kind of slop, you know, dirt-wise and rodents and rat, mice nests that go with it, not rats, mice nesting that goes with it and all that. Even found dead pigeons that were buried in pigeon poop so deep you couldn't even see the pigeon. And over a period of time, I just a combination of finding out about hantavirus and, you know, what it's about and where it's at, kind of find out that you know, the potential is very definite that we could have it out here. Matter of fact, it's been documented out across the river at Mesa.
True, it has.
Farmer plowing his field, and there's been other people that have died, like in Grandview, Granger, stuff like that. So anyhow, through default, no one else wanting to do that job, I ended up becoming quite the expert at it, according to Ray Giddings of Pest Control. And not only did we end up cleaning up our own facilities, but Ray Giddings also came to us if other facilities wanted to have cleanup. Now, we didn't do very many other facilities, but we did do some.
Did you ever run into any bats?
I never saw any.
And these would be little storage sheds, metal, wood, what would they be?
It could be just about anything, but Conex's was one towards the late 80s and up till now that is of most use and ends up being most infested.
And they are unventilated Conex's that leave, is that right?
The way they come on site, but our sheet metal and millwright guys ended up putting in some wind turbine deals in them.
Okay.
And that helped with the air circulation a little bit, but the hantavirus thing was definitely a possibility, and the Hanford site was doing a poor job of trying to prevent it because these Conexes were right on the ground. And it was like a freeway going in and out of there. If the door was left ajar, a lot of them didn't have good door seals. But over a period of time, I ended up finding a very cheap and inexpensive and effective way to go ahead and fix it. And that was to put the Conexes up on a recessed railroad tie, recessed slightly from the front. And therefore, the mouse didn't have something to just jump up on and hop in. They couldn't get over that barrier. So it was a simple, easy fix. And I ended up saving the company tens of thousands of dollars because we started doing all our Conexes like that. And I had one Conex that was infested like with 23, 27 mice when I first started doing it. And had pest control put some sticky traps there, and I ended up getting, like I say, 23 to 27 mice in about two and a half weeks time, something like that. And after that, of course, all the stuff that they'd been on had to be decontaminated. Decontamination, part of our job as an operator, even though you don't like it.
What about pesticides? Were when you went in after these rodent areas, had these ever been sprayed, or do you feel you were exposed to any pesticides?
No, they weren't at all. We ended up spraying them with bleach water, and we were in full Tyvek PPE and mask and nitrile gloves and reddish legging type rubber boots, which is what it called for by the videotape that I had obtained from Center of Disease Control and our Health and Safety Department after I had requested it. And I also was responsible for getting the procedure for cleaning up those areas developed for tank farms.
So before that, it was just you go do it like you would in your garage.
Yeah.
No procedure, just go do it.
Well, I mean, just sweep it up and get rid of it.
Yeah.
In reality, you need to have respiratory protection from that type of entry. Otherwise, you stand a very good chance. That's the way we are now, is they want to treat every burrowing animal at Hanford as a potential carrier of antibodies. So not just the deer mouse you hear about.
What about herbicides sprayed in the tank farms to control vegetation?
I know some people have complained and been sick over that. I didn't notice it directly myself as far as feeling sick that I know of, but you could smell it.
You could smell it?
Oh, yeah.
Was it, how often would they apply this?
I don't know how many times a year.
A few times. Did they color it so that you could see?
Right, it was colored for a good many years now.
Okay.
Which is a good idea.
Sure.
But there was a lack of informing, say, like a group that had this building, and they were spraying everywhere else, or maybe across the street. They wouldn't tell a group. That's usually where your complaints would come, is somebody to start smelling the stuff, and then whatever symptoms they had, just nauseous or headache. I've kind of heard both of them.
Did you ever feel those?
I can't recall now. I mean, when you're sick with other stuff, it's kind of hard to tell.
Right. I was going to ask about, you have here from 1998, sodium storage warehouse cleanup and sampling of stains on floors at 2727WA, which is...
Right.
It's a sodium warehouse, right?
Right.
Can you talk about that?
It was infested up there.
Oh, it was an infestation.
Yeah. It was infested, and I went and cleaned up almost all of it myself.
Where did this waste go?
It can be disposed of as regular trash after you double bag it, according to procedure.
Okay. I'm kind of glancing at the work history again. I see another one here in 1999, cleaned up a 300 area building per request from DynCorp. Was that...
I have the pictures on that.
Was that part of the firehouse? A 300 area firehouse?
I don't have any idea that it was ever a firehouse. It darn sure was never used for that I know of.
Because I can't remember, but I do recall in 99 being called out to a, to work on the publicity or the press release when they found a radioactive bat in a 300 area facility, and I thought it was the 300 area.
Well,
but it might
this
not
section
have.
Of the building was actually three different sections of the building that we cleaned up, and the stuff was so deep. There are places like 14, 17 inches deep with bird droppings and dead birds that are nothing but bone left underneath there because all the little microbes have eaten everything else.
Mm. And you did or did not wear a respirator?
We wore the right PPE like I described before. We had the one-piece Tyvek zipped up. We had our respirator, and we were dealing with particulate, although at the time We also had the multi-purpose cartridge.
Right.
So we opted to use the multi-purpose in case the odors got too strong.
When
a chemical cartridge, in other words, is what I'm saying.
When did the multi-purpose cartridge come in? I know as we've talked earlier today, we haven't mentioned chemical cartridges. In fact, we've mentioned their absence. When did they start?
The closest that I can track it is 1993. And I don't think there was any use before that, especially at tank farms. I know there wasn't, but I don't know if it was available anywhere.
Okay. Can we go back to 93? I keep going back to that because that's when you really became quite sick.
Yeah.
And so you had various symptoms and were not getting the right answers. But at the time, you really had no idea if it could be chemical or heavy metal.
No.
So you were searching for something, whether you had MS or lupus or allergies or something. And was there any point that, you know, you felt better or worse, or you got some different ideas that maybe you were getting less than the full range of answers?
Well, during those time frames there, after I go to the doctor, like I mentioned, I might get the right sulfa drug or penicillin or something like that to where it would make me feel good for a little while. I think I'd get on the rebound, and then boom, I get nailed all over again with something.
Do you think? So, go ahead.
I don't think I ever fully recovered for a good long time. And thank God it's not that bad anymore. But I used to get up after a decent night's sleep, what you'd consider a decent night's sleep, and I could be standing up in the kitchen talking to the family, and I'd have tears going down my cheeks, both my cheeks, and it wasn't crying. I was so damn exhausted that I could barely stay awake. That was that was an hour after I'd wake up. That's how bad off I was. And my family saw me with that. Yeah, they're more than willing to talk about that.
They would, of course, ask you, would they say, are you crying or what's the matter?
Well, no, they knew I wasn't crying, but they also knew that I was so exhausted. When the weekends had come up, instead of going out and working the yard and stuff, I'd try to do it, and I'd be so darn exhausted, I'd end up sleeping all weekend. And became almost like a hermit to the rest of the family. They knew that I was going through some sort of ordeal.
I'm not quite clear on when did you get, and how did you get the idea that it would be chemical? Did you see a TV show, or how did this enter your mind?
I can't recall for sure, but the more you started hearing mention about wonderful things like ferrocyanide, don't they kill people with that? You know, or do they extract radioactive product like they would gold or you know, precious metals? But then I started thinking, why have they got these kind of things here? And maybe they found that not only can they extract gold and other precious things they need, but maybe they can extract somewhere down the line their precious plutonium too with the stuff. Yeah. So, you know, it's not as though you think of it and the wheels just keep going and going and going. You might think of it as a passing thought, and then maybe you're doing something else and you don't think about it anymore for a while.
Can you talk about when Fluor came in 1996 and the transition from Westinghouse? Fluor was running the tank farms at that time, and they came in. They had a subcontractor, Lockheed Martin. But what changes did you see when Westinghouse left and the new team came in?
Well, with Fluor, they never did have any credibility that I know of. The former general, Hank Hatch, who was head of the Corps of Engineers, come in and run Fluor at the time, and after he is here 2, 3, 4 months, he says, I don't see any morale problem out here. Everybody's happy. Well, if he talks to the office people, where their biggest concern is a paper cut or falling out of their recliner chair, you might be right. But when they combine the office people with the field level people, your results are highly skewed. You have almost 100% satisfaction on one hand with the office folks, where with the field level personnel, I agreed with Hank Hatch entirely. There is no morale problem at tank farms because you have to have something before you have a problem with it.
Explain that. Explain that more.
If you don't have any morale, which Westinghouse took very thorough care of, like I mentioned about the way they purged the knowledgeable people out of tank farms,
then
you have the likes of Dave Reber or Steve Youngerman heading up a safety council, where you had to justify yourself about a safety problem before they would even accept it at the council level. This is the kind of mentality that we were fighting during those times. It was also the times of Inez Austin identifying all the problems that I imagine almost all of them turned out to be very legitimate. But very terrible times in Westinghouse. Floor came in. Okay, Hank Hatch is living in a dream. The real relief that we saw was that when Lockheed Martin came in, that we probably wish to this day that they would have never left, because it really looked like they turned things around and were going in the right direction, respecting the working people out in the field, the ones that can make them or break them.
How did they show that?
Just by example instead of talking. They show it by example.
By coming out more often or by,
Coming out responsive to stuff that needs fixing. Just a variety of things. They had a believability factor that was there, like, it hadn't been there since Rockwell.
I'm looking into my notes for a second to think about the Lockheed years. I have here for 1996. There's still a lot of pumping in the single shell tanks, pumping out. SY-101 and 103 are still listed as flam gas tanks. There's a group called the SubTap, which is Technical something panel, Technical Achievement Panel or something, that was an advisory group to Lockheed, and they're meeting to talk about the tanks. And gas generation reports are issued for SY-101 and 103. And then I find a gas release event from SY-103 on June 6, 1996, with a peak hydrogen concentration of 1,020 VPPM. Did any of those events, you know, kind of spark any thoughts of what was going on right then in your mind?
No, I can't really comment to that.
I also find headspace tests in SY-102. So I assume those are vapor samples.
Right.
Go on to 97 and then 98. And especially in 98, we find the crust starts to build up on SY-101.
Right.
And they begin to notice it and to get busy trying to see what they're going to do with the crust. Did you have to do any more sampling, extra sampling, or were you gone from the SY farm at that point?
I was involved with SY farm until several months after the mixer pump was installed. And I wasn't always with the mixer pump. I was just occasionally, because at that time I said that I was transitioning over to supply and handling the emergency response equipment.
I see. I find also in November of 97, the DOE announces that tank waste has leaked out and has reached groundwater. That, you know, that sort of created a lot of public interest. Did that mean much to the folks in the field, or did they say to themselves, well, we always knew that, or what do you think?
I think it was a revelation to a lot of people.
Really?
Because there was a lot of new people on there. And there was, you know, so much more revelation about old spills, even just recently. There's documents that are out there that are very thorough about old spills. And like I say, some of them covered acres. They had to go ahead and windrow it with a road grader, wash it down with a fire truck type deal, wash it into the soil instead of picking it up. Then they'd go ahead and use plastic or rubber or lead sheet to put over it. And, you know, whatever it took basically to make it go away, then you put gravel and rock on it. Oh, you're talking earlier about putting gravel on so many of the farms, right?
Right, right.
Yeah. There's a ex-boss. Thank God he's ex. ex-Navy nuke sub guy. He's a real big guy. And he thought he could intimidate everybody by his size. And if he banged his fist real hard on the table and yelled at everybody at the meeting, that was the introductory meeting about, you know, hey, I'm the new guy, we want to help you and all that stuff. But after a few minutes, everybody thinking that he really wanted to help and know what's going on, that's when he yelled out and slammed his fist down on the table nice and loud. He says, quit your bitching. And he found out real quick that he can't rule by intimidation because we're not a bunch of 17-year-olds like he'd been dealing with.
What did he, you know, is there a specific incident where, you know, he crossed somebody or somebody crossed him and there was a, you know, kind of a time when authority gets established and he realized that he couldn't do that?
Well, he found out real quick when he was dealing with union protection. And another deal is that this particular guy kept himself from getting fired, but just barely. He did get some unpaid time off. He was shift manager at the time, and it was over 272WA across from the parking lot. We had a trailer there that was the shift office. And so he was shift manager that particular evening, and was on swing shift. And lo and behold, he locked himself out. Okay, well, he'll get right on the radio and call patrol. No, he didn't have his radio. It was locked inside the trailer. So instead of going somewhere else and finding patrol to let him in with their security keys that they have and saying, hey, okay, sorry, he took a tire iron out of the back of his car and proceeded to demolish the metal security door and got in there. Well, like I say, the only thing that kept him from losing his job, because he spoke in front of everybody in the lunchroom and admitted his mistake, and everybody popped up unanimously when he says that he needed to get back in. There was a whole bunch of people that says, well, why didn't you call patrol? Because that's the way we're trained. Call patrol. That's the only place that makes sense, you know. And, oh, I didn't think about it, you know, blah, blah. Well, here you are, a guy in charge. You can't even think of something basic like that. But I'm telling you, that's the kind of mentality that we've had in charge of us out there. That's why I'm ready to see some pluses. CHG looks like they're turning it around because they have to turn it around or they're gone.
I was going to ask if we could talk about when the ORP, the Office of River Protection, was created in 98, and then, beginning of fiscal 99. And then when the CHG took over from Lockheed, what changed? How was that?
When CHG took over from Lockheed?
It's probably a lot of reorganization, right?
Yeah, and after a short period of time, didn't take long to find out that, well, back to square one again.
CHG?
CHG did not come over well until recently. Now they're starting to come around more. And part of it is because of this council. Part of it is because it looks like they might start to take care of people like they should have all along. Realizing that they inherited an alligator from DOE, because DOE never told them, I'll bet you, about the kind of traps that are out there in tank farms in the way of chemical problems. I would not guarantee that, although I have nothing in evidence.
Well, I find some things, I'm going back and forth a little bit now, but from 1998, find a incident. It says contamination area 100 yards east of SY tank farm. And then another one at the SY farm change trailer. There were no contamination area signs, no rad signs at all, and only an uncolored metal barrier, metal chain. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I didn't list that in my stuff.
No, I found that somewhere.
I know that that's happened before.
And I know that in the same year, there was a write-up from DOE against the contractor for keeping people for long periods with no breaks in the middle of the summer, monitoring the SY tank farm.
Yeah. Wouldn't doubt that at all. We got a supervisor during that time, but there was several supervisors in the same boat that they were famous for not giving lunches, but working right through. And it's definitely got to be an identified problem.
When they did the pump out of SY-101, half of the contents pumped out in the back deletion of it, in 2000, were you part of that?
In 2000? No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I was pretty well in the supply side and emergency response side then.
Okay. For your work history, it says for 2000 and 2001, facility surveillance handling package of nuclear chemical waste monitoring gauges, decon equipment, field sampling, handling and storing supplies. Can you just talk about that in general? Like what?
That's all general duties that an operator is expected to do. If you're trained in routines and you got your certifications, that's general duties.
Okay, but you were in and around and about the tank farms quite a bit.
Right.
Did you have to dress out very much to do these jobs, or pretty much?
If it was in the farms, I'd dress out, yeah.
Okay.
But wouldn't be around an area that would require masks.
Were you feeling better by then, a little bit?
In what year?
2000, 2001.
I was still unresolved and big question mark. I can't really say I was feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have the tears going down my cheeks and total exhaustion, but I wasn't far from it.
Mm-hmm.
I think during that time frame, maybe a little bit sooner, the one doctor wrote down fibromyalgia.
And what is that?
Oh, God. Generally deteriorated to the point, I guess, where total exhaustion. There's just, I looked it up, but to be specific about the symptoms now, I could find it in my medical records, and I could find it on the description of fibromyalgia, but to spout it off the top of my head, I'm sorry.
How much were you spending of your own money each year up for doctors at this point, doctors and medicines?
I wouldn't be surprised if it would be $1,000 a year with no answers.
Yeah. Let's see. What began to change? Was it when they had the vapor issues come up in 2004 that, you know, everything began to change for you, or what was the thing that
Yeah, really it did, because like I say, with the research that I was doing and the things that I was suspicioning, those were the ones that I looked up first, and I said to myself, you know, damn, or you bastards, you know, that they could let this kind of stuff go with it and leave me hanging like that.
And was your anger at the doctors of HHF, or was it at the company, the employing company?
Just the callous attitude that they could play God with people's life.
And at what point did you start to speak out, or did you start to say, I'm going to get myself tested for heavy metals or chemicals?
Well, it was kind of a combination of things that I knew there was other people that were messed up.
Yeah.
And then I had a buddy that got splashed with that tank waste, Dan Golden. And I've known him for years and years and years. And to see how he was treated, and, you know, it obviously was pointed that it was definitely a chemical exposure from these folks. You know, and there are some other instances. I mean, there's a buddy that blew his brains out with a shotgun. There's an old boss from years back that blew his brains out with a shotgun. And if you knew him, he was just not the kind of guy that he's the last guy on earth you'd ever expect to do that. But then, you know, you look up these chemicals and what they can do to your mind, and it's the wrong person is playing God out there.
And who is that?
The people in charge.
Okay. Now do you feel they know that now they have the knowledge, or when do you think they have the knowledge? Or was it that they didn't have the knowledge, but they were remiss in that they didn't look for it?
Well, you had to get past the reality check of how can there be that many people complaining about the same thing without there being some substance to it. And yet, obviously, you're going to be in a state of denial, I think, with whatever it is. And say, God, that couldn't happen here. You know, I don't want anything to do with that. It can't be. But, you know, I think CHG got their reality check, checked with enough toxicology experts, and at least they found out what it was that they were dealing with. But they haven't told us yet what we're dealing with, because they're thinking of the pocketbook instead of the reality and the therapy that you might be able to get to make yourself better.
Is it, do you think that in 2004 that most people were surprised that it was chemical vapors?
Yeah.
And
I really do.
And it came about because of all the intense activity at C-106 and trying to remediate that tank, is that right?
I don't know if it's C-106 or not, but I'd sure like to know the list of contents for each tank in there. And I had that request in. Even yesterday, I got an email stating that I would get it. I don't know if it's waiting for me today when I come back or not.
You wonder, do they have it? Or how expensive would it be to go
test? They keep saying they have it.
Oh, they do?
Well, yeah. Time and time again, we know what's in those tanks.
Because I know they did, you know, an intense characterization program. They had to.
They lost a lot of the core sampling data that they had with Dan Hartley and Butch Hall and Jim Lee's bunch. And at least that's what I heard, is that they lost a lot of that data.
When
or,
they, When they took the tank samples in the 90s, you know, to address the watch list and other items,
right.
Did they test for every chemical or did they not? Do you know if they had a limited spectrum of what they tested for?
I feel sure and confident that as hard as it's been for them to admit to anything, that they admitted to even less during that time frame. Because the more you admit to, the more people are going to be wondering. And, of course, we had to keep, you know, they had to keep that down to a low roar.